Hey, it's a fresh week. Welcome back, everybody, to another week at the Damage Report. I'm John Iderola. Hey, Brooke, how's it going?
Hey, you.
Hey.
You're back.
I'm back, and I feel lagged.
You're an interesting color, too.
It's I've always said
sun-kissed.
That.
Sun-kissed.
I've always said that. But yes, I've gotten a lot of sun.
Just kidding, you look great.
Anyway, I was gone for the week in Hawaii, and I'm burned. Despite using suntan lotion. Thank you for holding things down last week.
No,
people seemed to really like it.
It was fun. Yeah, people missed you though.
Apparently from the views, they did not. They were doing quite well with you guys.
I'm so
excited to be back. And it feels good, like we've been talking recently about burnout. It feels good to not be burned out for like a day.
Is that what happened?
I'll be burned out again.
Like you got to fully relax and like,
I did.
You were on Twitter a lot.
I did. There was
for
just
someone
some
who
stuff.
Was letting go, but.
No, I didn't tweet that much.
Yeah, okay.
But there was the stuff with Steven Crowder and Donald Trump was still president, so you can only relax so much.
You can only let go so much.
Yeah, and
I understand.
And I'm feeling okay, and I'm ready to get overwhelmed again in the next 24 to 48 hours.
Yeah.
And to do that, we've got a lot of stories we're gonna be talking about. So we're gonna be starting off with a couple different tales of corruption from within the Trump administration. We've got the DNC apparently not caring much about climate change later on. Ted Cruz not knowing how social media works. Donald Trump's absolutely cruel desires for the design of the wall. And along the way, we've got two awesome guests. One is gonna be joining us from Public Citizen a little bit later on in the show to talk about the Koch brothers and how they're getting their claws into university research centers around the country. And in just a little bit, Emma Vigeland's gonna be joining us to talk about her recent interview with AOC, who's apparently her best friend because she sits down with her all the time, it seems like, making me jealous every single time. But before that, let's talk about Jared Kushner a little bit.
Let's do it.
Okay. One of the companies co-owned by Jared Kushner has apparently gotten about $90 million in anonymous foreign investment in recent times. This is Cadre, and Jared Kushner's holding in this company is valued at $50 million according to financial disclosure documents. So he owns $50 million of ownership stake in this company, Cadre, and they've received $90 million in foreign funding that we have no idea where it actually comes from. And so understand his involvement with this particular company, what it is and what it isn't. So he resigned from its board and reduced his ownership stake to less than 25% after he joined the White House. This is actually one of those companies that he initially failed to list on his first ethics disclosures, later adding the company and saying that the omission was inadvertent. And that's a case that might seem a little bit ridiculous, but he was leaving so many things off of those documents that this one might have just been like slipped in amongst them without him really realizing. The company also says that he's not actively involved in its decisions, which sort of makes sense. He's not on its board anymore. He doesn't own a majority share or anything like that, but he still does own quite a bit of it. And it's been receiving a lot of money coming apparently from foreign countries. We don't know exactly for sure which, but we do have two sources that say that some of the money apparently came to the Cayman Islands vehicle that's helping to manage that money and the transfers from international sources. Some came from Saudi Arabia. Is anybody surprised by that?
No.
At this point,
would that have been your if you had to just guess?
One country?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Right. Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Like his brother and he there. They always seem to be there.
Mm-hmm. And he's got this great lovey-dovey relationship with MBS, the brutal dictator of Saudi Arabia. And look. He's had multiple opportunities in the past 6 months or so to be a human when it comes to Saudi Arabia and what they've done, including the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. And he refused to do that, even recently in that interview that
right,
I believe you guys covered.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
we didn't get to touch on that part of it.
Uh-huh.
We didn't get to, there were so many things that we didn't get to touch on because he just sat there and just didn't answer questions or lied.
Mm-hmm. The only question that his interview really answered was, why doesn't Jared Kushner do more interviews? This provided a great answer for that. But yeah, I understand.
But then it created more questions because then even more so you're like, why is he there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this company so we can get an idea of whether this is an instance of corruption. I mean, I personally think that the continued financial entanglements that Donald Trump and others in the administration have with companies that do work abroad is by itself an issue. But let's delve a little bit deeper. The company Cadre was founded back in 2014 by Kushner, his brother Joshua, and their friend Ryan Williams, who previously worked for Goldman Sachs. The company operates from a building in Manhattan owned by the Kushner family's real estate corporation, and the fund's value has risen fivefold since 2017 when Kushner was appointed a White House advisor following earlier slower growth, which is really a pattern that I'm getting very used to, where Donald Trump, Jared Kushner, these are guys that were handed business opportunities and fortunes when they came of age. They largely squandered it going from one bad real estate deal to another. Right. And that's certainly true of Jared Kushner in recent years. And then what do you know? Once they get into a position of political power, suddenly things start to look better for them. And these companies that had not been doing particularly well suddenly are getting big influxes of investment, principally from outside of the United States. That's a pattern that's true for both Donald Trump and Jared Kushner.
People from a certain demographic in this country always seem to fall up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so,
like the president.
Exactly. Oh, no, I got where you're going there. We have like 50 years of that in his experience.
Right.
So Kushner says that he has excluded himself from government policy on real estate. A footnote to his financial disclosure form said he is recused from particular matters in the broker-dealer, real estate, and online financial services sectors to the extent they would have a direct and predictable effect on cadre. But maybe that's true.
He's not recused from making money.
No, not at all. He still has influence. And I mean, if the money is coming, let's say I have no idea what percentage of the money was coming from Saudi Arabia. We can't even be sure that it did. We have two anonymous sources that say that it did. But it would be one thing if he is setting real estate policy in a way that would benefit a company like Cadre that works in real estate and helps people to do joint purchases of real estate and stuff like that. That's certainly a way that Cadre making more money and then them setting policy to help them make more money would certainly be corrupt. But if he is helping to set the foreign policy of the United States towards a country like Saudi Arabia, and then a company he owns a significant chunk of, a quarter of the entire company, is receiving significant foreign investment, that too is corruption. It's just not as easy to identify because the driving, I guess, the sector that company operates in is not the thing that he is doing the corruption in.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that it's not corruption. I'm glad that this reporting is coming out and people are taking it seriously today, but this has the reek of one of those stories that will be news for a day. And then in 2 months, we'll remember briefly. And they'll be like, hey, you remember when they got $90 million? And
right,
he made a bunch?
Realistically, he can't ever really recuse himself from all matters that relate to positive aspects of him sitting on the president, being part of the White House administration and owning a company that would be directly affected by decisions made here. That's just not possible.
Yeah.
That's why it's best to leave these companies.
To not be involved with them, exactly.
Exactly, but also we've seen that over and over and over again with not even just the administration, but with the GOP, period. We're talking about Mitch McConnell's wife, also Steve Mnuchin, so this is kind of their thing.
It's vaguely swampy. And he says he's not directly involved in real estate policy making. And I'm sure he's very busy with solving the Middle East peace crisis. And I think he's also trying to fix Syria or something, all these areas that he's quite qualified to engage in. But what do you think? Like, he's a senior White House aide and official. He's in those conversations. Do you think he's running out of the room when real estate comes up? Like, if Ben Carson walks in the door, does he bolt? I kind of doubt it.
And I wish Ben Carson would run out of the room.
That would be nice too. But let's turn to another somewhat pettier instance of corruption.
Okay.
Donald Trump returned from his overseas trip. You guys did a great job of breaking down some of the ridiculous stuff that happened there.
You know, I like compliments.
You do, and so does Donald Trump. So let's turn to him. His company made a little bit of money thanks to this trip. So Trump's Ireland golf course visit cost taxpayers $3.6 million. And so I'm just catching up on all that happened in this trip. He apparently was staying in Ireland because it was convenient, even though the work that he was doing, the meetings he was having, were in France. So over 600 miles away, he decided to stay at the place where it was convenient. Now, he didn't say geographically convenient, but it certainly is financially convenient that the State Department could be reimbursing your company because you choose to stay there rather than in literally the country where you're having these meetings. So let's talk a little bit about why it was that expensive.
Okay.
The expenses included over $1 million for car and limo rentals, which it seems like at that point you could just buy the cars and that would be cheaper, maybe store them at the golf course for the next time you choose to stay there conveniently. $10,000 to install temporary phone lines, $16,000 so that the Secret Service could ride around on golf carts following him while he played. And so the State Department was responsible for $1.5 million in contracts for the trip. So this is a convenient little thing where he decides to stay there. And because of that, a company that he owns, a golf course that he owns, makes millions of dollars.
We are just not there as a country at all as far as, you know, how many people, the percentage of people in this country who are struggling to eat every day and feed their children. We're just not there in this country for that to be a thing. Mm-hmm. And I know, again, we're talking about types of corruption that aren't just the president. We see this in local city councils, mm-hmm. but it's a problem.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
and this bothers me. It's millions of dollars for him. And yes, you want the president to still be able to be a normal person. That's not what I'm saying. But a millions of dollars for a golf trip, mm-hmm. that's a problem.
Yeah, I want him to be a normal person. But I personally don't think that a normal person needs to take 180 taxpayer-funded trips to his own golf courses.
I agree.
Since he became president. That's absolutely absurd, which, by the way, the total cost to taxpayers is more than $100 million. Now, look, we talk about stories all the time that have far larger bills. I get that. And the problem of corruption is not a problem of trips to golf courses necessarily. There's far bigger structural corruption. That's mm-hmm. true. But that doesn't mean that he gets a pass on all this. It doesn't mean that weird things like his son's buying rounds for people at a bar in Ireland and then skipping out on the tab, which is just absurd. We don't have time to talk about it. All of this stuff, like, we have to at least fit in some recognition for it, because to the extent that this becomes normalized under Donald Trump, it will be normalized for future politicians as well, presidents, but possibly lower too. I don't want the government to become a piggy bank for wealthy businessmen to buy their way into politics and then to enrich themselves at our expense.
I agree.
So with that, we're going to take a short break. We come back, Emma Vigeland's going to be joining us. She sat down once again with AOC. We're going to be talking about the results of that interview after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today. And get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Joining us once again, Emma Vigeland. How's it going, Emma?
It's going good. Looking tan and happy.
That's what I was talking about.
I'm not that tan. I'm red and I look aged.
I feel like
definitely
your face
aged.
Is tan. Your face is tan, and then when you move
I
down.
Guess. I had suntan lotion on. I don't know what I'm doing, but I aged
Did you
like
have suntan lotion or sunscreen?
I don't know. I put something with an SPF. It was reef safe. I don't know. Okay. Did you know, by the way, that lotion is supposed to be reef safe? Please make sure that yours is reef safe. Anyway, we were going to talk about AOC or something. So, Emma, you recently got to once again sit down with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So congratulations for that. I'm always jealous every time I see that you're hanging out with your bestie. And there's a few different things that you talked about with her that I would like to get into. The first has to do with she had this interaction online with Ted Cruz, and it turns out that that's actually bearing fruit. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that was kind of an exclusive that we got, which I was very excited about. It makes me feel very official. And it was just that it wasn't just a Twitter exchange that they're going to work on some sort of ban for when members of Congress leave, they can't become lobbyists. Ted Cruz surprisingly agreed with her on Twitter, and they had this exchange back and forth. And now, apparently, according to Ocasio-Cortez, their legislative teams are actually meeting. So this is something that's actually happening. Ted Cruz is interested, at least on its face, or on his face, which I don't like to think about very much, that he wants to ban former members of Congress, senators, congresspeople from becoming lobbyists once they leave. Because it's it's very problematic in two ways. One is that these members of Congress have deep relationships with the politicians. So when they're working on behalf of an industry, their former colleagues, they're going to have immediate access to them, their friends, other members of their party, et cetera. And also, it means that when you're in public service, when you're a representative, you might be less tough on those industries. You might be trying to cater to those industries so you can get a cushy lobbyist job when you do leave Congress.
So I'm interested in both if you got a feeling from her and also your opinion that I know that Ted Cruz does occasionally disagree with other Republicans, but he's also one of the slimiest creatures ever. I was just in Hawaii. I didn't see anything as slimy as Ted Cruz there. Do you think he's actually trustworthy on this topic, that he's not just trying to affiliate his name with, you know, one of the hottest names in politics, that he would actually go all the way on this?
So I asked her specifically if she thought that he was using her for publicity, because he hasn't been in the news recently, and except for his beard, which I have mixed feelings about. She said that she was skeptical too, and she wants to know, and they're trying to work out if he's actually trying to work on a lobbyist ban in earnest, because apparently there's an overwhelming majority of the members of Congress who do become lobbyists aren't actually technically registered lobbyists. There are so many loopholes so that these former members of Congress can be lobbyists without actually having to declare themselves as lobbyists. So the language that she's trying to work on with Ted Cruz's team would be, you know, we're not just doing this to adhere to the letter of the law as it is in its current manifestation. We want to ban members of Congress from lobbying, even if they aren't actually officially registered as lobbyists, because that's just a fraction of the actual totality of the people.
Makes sense. Last week, Joe Biden got a lot of negative coverage for the weird back and forth over the Hyde Amendment. What does AOC think about both the future of the Hyde Amendment and anything involving the sort of political back and forth over that?
Yeah, she was pretty candid, I believe, in the fact that she's just not going to endorse Joe Biden. I mean, we knew that already, but she has wanted to hold off and said that she's not going to endorse until the New York primary, which is very late in the primary process. I can't imagine that she's going to wait that long, but that's her position at the current moment. And she said verbatim, this is the support of the Hyde Amendment is not a progressive position, is what she said, and that she can't, you can't claim to be a progressive and support something like the Hyde Amendment. The day that that interview aired, or that clip aired later in the evening, Joe Biden actually reversed his position. I have no idea if her forceful rebuke of his progressive credentials on that front had anything to do with that, but the backlash was pretty severe from the get-go. I mean, we've talked about this before, but Joe Biden claiming to be the most progressive candidate in the race, have the most progressive record, is laughable at the very least. He's been wrong on nearly every single policy position, major ones, when you go back in history. The ones where, not everyone, I mean, yeah, he's a Democrat and he's had some great votes, but when you're looking at differentiators between candidates like Bernie Sanders and candidates like Joe Biden, who have a significant legislative record, one clearly stands out as having the foresight to vote in the correct way, while the other has voted for the Iraq War, amongst many other issues, and tried to double down on the Hyde Amendment until the political pressure was too much.
And seems mostly unapologetic about all of those diversions from the record you would want to have if you were claiming to be the progressive in the race. One other topic I want to talk to you about. You mentioned a little bit about endorsements. I know that AOC has said that she's obviously, I mean, she seems to like Bernie quite a bit, and she's impressed with Elizabeth Warren, who in the most recent polls has been going up in Iowa. Has she said anything else about like any other candidates that might be standing out to her? Has she given you any indication that she's a part of the Yang gang or anything like that?
No, but she did say in the interview that Medicare for All, Green New Deal, College for All, that's pretty much her litmus test. Now, we have one of those two candidates who's equivocating on Medicare for All, and that's Elizabeth Warren. To me, I think it's incredibly clear who the two most progressive candidates are. I know people like to throw Tulsi Gabbard out there, but when you look at her record, it's a lot more of a mixed bag than I think the online Tulsi Gang, that's what you said, Yang Gang, it came to me, would like to admit. But really only one, Elizabeth Warren's biggest issue right now in her campaign, I know she's had a history of voting for the military budgets, et cetera, but she's largely course-corrected in many of those areas recently, is Medicare for All. She's actively distancing herself from that, which leads me to believe that there's really one candidate that Ocasio-Cortez could endorse, and that's Bernie Sanders.
And if I could add on just a little bit to that, so I know that you had tweeted earlier today, there was a photo going around of Elizabeth Warren that she has a sign for that, all these signs of different issue areas. Yeah. And you tweeted that there wasn't one for Medicare for All. And I thought, well, is that really fair? Like, she doesn't have it on a sign, but I'm sure, like, for instance, if I go to her campaign website, it's gotta be one of the top things. And so I went to ElizabethWarren.com and it was not one of the things listed on her website. And so I thought, points for Vigeland there.
Well, no, I mean, look, I'm a huge Elizabeth Warren fan, and I've said that the backlash against her from some of the Bernie Sanders fans, and I would include myself in that, it's ridiculous. It's so over the top. There's not one candidate that's closer to the issues than Elizabeth Warren. And, you know, she's even better on some issues than Bernie Sanders is, and more detailed, I would say, with her tuition-free college plan. She's clearly worse on foreign policy and clearly worse on Medicare for All. There's no way around it. But I think like what bothers people most about her is that she's very politicky in the things that she chooses not to focus on. So she's clearly distancing herself from Medicare for All. And it's kind of reminiscent of what she did in 2016, where she's made an obvious calculation and she doesn't really have an answer for it. And that's a bummer about her. So I think that AOC is going to endorse Bernie Sanders, and I think it's pretty obvious.
Well, I would just say one additional thing for people watching who want Elizabeth Warren to move back in the right direction on Medicare for All. I doubt that Elizabeth Warren sees the path to the nomination as trying to get like Klobuchar fans. She seems to be taking some support for Bernie Sanders, and if she wants to keep that support, if she wants to get more of it, Medicare for All is not an optional issue. So I would say that a lot of targeted pressure on Elizabeth Warren needs to be centered around her not focusing on healthcare policy. As you pointed out on Twitter, it's obviously at the top of people's priority list pretty much every election. So I think that in the next few months, when they're still really paying attention to what's polling well, we need to make sure that she understands that there's no path for her that does not involve Medicare for All.
And I would just add that I think that part of her calculation is that she thinks the elimination of private healthcare is too extreme. And I think that people do think that that's too extreme in some instances. So that's really the calculation that she's making. But then she has to be clear on what her vision would be if it's not Bernie Sanders's Medicare for All vision. How are you going to provide healthcare for everyone while still maintaining some sort of semblance of a private healthcare industry? Yeah. And I don't know if it's possible.
Well, as always, Emma, always good to have you on. Congratulations on not only sitting down with AOC, but also breaking some news with AOC.
Thanks so much, John. Congratulations on getting engaged, which is a big deal.
That's my meeting again. Well, thank you. And we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
We're gonna take a short break. When we come back, we're gonna talk about why there's not gonna be a climate-focused DNC debate, and Ted Cruz figures out a little bit about Twitter after this. Time for a bit of a debate here on the Damage Report.
Oh, don't do that.
Over a climate-focused debate in the Democratic primary. It's been a big topic of discussion for the last week or so, with Tom Perez telling a group of activists it's just not practical. He added, and as someone who worked for Barack Obama, the most remarkable thing about him was his tenacity to multitask. And a president must be able to multitask, which is a weird evasion. Whether you think there should be a climate-focused debate or not, I don't really see what that has to do with anything.
Right.
He goes on to say, so these debates, and we will have issue areas in debates, including but not limited to climate, but it's just not practical for us to have one debate on democracy reform, one debate on voting. So here's what we do in addition. There are candidate forums that are separate from debates. Which is true. There will be 1 billion town halls on CNN through the course of this primary. Many of them will be focused on particular issue areas, which is awesome. It's not the same necessarily as a DNC debate. So let's just talk briefly. I know you feel like it's not necessary, right?
Yeah, I
because you don't care about climate change. You don't believe in the science.
Somebody's gonna clip that. It's just gonna be just said. I'm gonna get tweets about it forever. And I have been to you, keeping your show afloat.
You did. Thank
while
you.
While you were swimming in the ocean.
Thank you.
Okay.
Rapidly rising ocean, by the way. So answer that.
I do care about climate change.
I wanted to see Hawaii while it exists.
Like to see, lots of questions and answers on climate change. I want to very clearly see where these candidates stand. But I think you and I both agree that we cannot have a separate debate on every single issue, right?
Not on every issue, but one of my frustrations with Tom Perez is that he referred to climate change as a single issue. And I do not see it. I don't even see it as just the biggest issue. It's mm-hmm. not one issue. It's an issue that touches all issues. It's right. a foundational, fundamental issue. It makes me think that he hasn't been paying attention to any of the conversation around the Green New Deal, the entire thrust of which is to convince people that this is not just about carbon, you know, parts per million. This is something that's going to affect foreign policy. It's going to affect wars between states, wars within states. Mm-hmm. It's going to affect jobs. It's going to affect environmental jobs. It's going to affect so many of these different things.
Absolutely. And I think that all you have to tell me is that we just want to save the earth so we can live on it a little bit longer. I
also want to do that.
You know, there. Okay. Even if you know what I mean, so I get that. But I do think that if I were to pick, and I hope this doesn't like make you cringe, but yeah, if I were to pick, like I want to talk about criminal justice. We have multiple candidates there. No, but I just feel like if we only had to pick one thing, right? Mm-hmm. Just one thing that we're just going to single and we're just going to talk about this for a debate. I want to talk about criminal justice. I want to get the hundreds of thousands of black and brown men home with their kids, with their wives, with their mothers, with their family, and not sitting in federal prison. Mm-hmm. For life without the possibility of parole for marijuana in states that marijuana can be bought by walking into a store. Yeah, I want to talk about that. I want to talk about, especially to the people where we have two of our front runners, whatever their reasoning, voted for a crime bill that disproportionately affected black and brown people. I want to talk about criminal justice. I want to talk about that with those two people. I want to talk about that with Elizabeth Warren. I want to talk about that with Kamala Harris. That is, I don't think that we should have to, I don't think that we should have to separate our identities, okay? So I'm a black person, I'm a woman. I am a human being that wants this earth to survive. Mm-hmm. You know, but yeah, like that is of the utmost importance to me. And that doesn't mean that it's not important to me to care about this earth. But I think that if we had to pick one thing, we all, I hate this and I hate talking about this. I hate being honest about like where I stand on certain things because I'm gonna be called a right winger or something like that because I care
well,
about getting black people
about
out of prisons that don't belong there. Mm-hmm. But
which is on its face not a position the right wing holds. So.
I know, but
I get what you're saying.
Why not have an entire debate on reparations? We just saw a study just last week where because of redlining in Chicago, mm-hmm. black people in just since I think the 70s lost $3 to $4 billions of dollars in mm-hmm. personal wealth.
Billions, that they could have had by having
that they
homes
could have had by yeah. without these races. So let's talk about that. Let's have but nobody even wants to. There is no even like really like it's a non-starter reparations. It's mm-hmm. a non-starter for a lot of people.
Well,
but like,
I'm assuming that there will be questions about it now.
Right.
Thanks to the fact that many candidates have talked about it. I would be perfectly fine with there being a debate focused on criminal justice reform. The thing though, and I get that this won't be persuasive because it wasn't during the break. there will be questions about criminal justice reform.
And there will be questions debates. About climate crisis.
There has
absolutely.
Never been, there have never, yes, they're saying that there will be.
You know there
but
will
I'm
be.
But I'm saying there have never been questions about
of
climate change at a debate.
The candidates are running on a platform based on that. I think that they would demand it. Of course there will
I would,
be.
Why? Well, yeah, and I think one way to push for that is to push for a debate. What I'm saying is we have gone all this time literally never focusing on climate change, mm-hmm. even though it's getting worse and worse in the background. We talk about a lot of issues.
Wrongly on criminal justice.
So sure,
now we need to
sure.
have a positive conversation about it. We need
and
to have a
I'm
fair
totally fine with having
it.
That. I just think that I would put this on the same level. I mean, for me personally, I would put it above in terms of importance because I think the future of our civilization, our species is on the line.
I agree, and I think that is important. For me, Before my little brother is in harm's way just walking out the door every day. He's got to make sure that he doesn't have on a hat that looks intimidating. He's got to make sure that wherever he's walking, his hands aren't in his pockets. He's got to make sure that he's not sagging. God mm-hmm. forbid he be in Shreveport, Louisiana with his underwear showing a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that like those, the fact that his life is on the line every time he potentially gets pulled over, mm-hmm. every time there is a report of some sort of crime committed and it happens to be a black man who did it, he is at risk of some form of aggressive stopping and frisking.
Like we were just talking about Hawthorne.
Exactly. That's number one. But just walking out the door, I can't even get to that point yet. Just walking out the door. So mm-hmm. that's always going to be, until it's fixed, that's always going to be something that I need us to focus a lot of our energy on. And so I can't just buy that. We talk about criminal justice. What do you mean? We always ask questions about it. I can't, you know.
Was that me?
No, I mean, it's just that like, it's still so broken that it doesn't even matter that we've talked about it before.
I understand that.
We may as well not have talked about it.
The questions having been there doesn't mean that we've solved it, but at least it is something that people acknowledge as an issue. Whereas we have, as a political system, we have pretended that climate change is not an issue for decades.
I feel like acknowledging it is not just talking about it, it's actually doing something about it.
But we're still just talking about debates. No legislation is going to be passed there, but at least some focus will be put on it. How about a compromise? We do both.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, we'll have focus on both of those and probably a couple other things. We'll put together a platform, we'll get Cenk to go to Iowa or something.
That's what we'll do,
and we'll push for it. Okay, let's do that. Okay, that's fair.
Did we agree?
There, going across the aisle from the progressives to the center.
No, just kidding.
Okay, anyway, so we're gonna take a short break. We come back, another interview for you after this. The Koch brothers and their money have a presence at many universities across America, but it's not always easily apparent that that's going on and what effect it might have both on the operations of universities and also on government policy. And joining us now to break down one particular aspect of this is Taylor Lincoln, Director of Research at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay? And thank you for having me.
I can. Thank you for joining us. So we wanted to talk about a recent write-up involving the George Washington University's Regulatory Studies Center, which talks about regulatory policy issues and apparently has a pretty strong connection with the Koch brothers. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this is a program that has this kind of anodyne name, the Regulatory Studies Center at George Washington University. It's run by a woman who was a Bush appointee at the end of the Bush administration that ran the she was effectively the government's regulatory czar at the end of the Bush administration. And this program purports to be a neutral, unbiased program, and we analyzed what their comments were. They comment to the government on regulations and found out that they come out against regulations ballpark about 98% of the time or 96% of the time.
Just out of curiosity, because I did find that statistic to be very interesting, do we have any idea what the 4% of the time is or the 2%? Like what regulations are they in favor of?
We actually do, and it's a kind of curious case. What they came out in favor of was a proposal by the FDA to regulate the nicotine content of cigarettes. But the proposal also included a request that they let free nicotine content in non-combustible cigarettes. So they regulated traditional cigarettes, and they wanted them to let free the nicotine content on non-combustible cigarettes, which makes me wonder if that was actually a backdoor deregulatory request as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. Are the non-combustible cigarettes, are we talking about like vaping or something like that?
I think so, yes.
Interesting, okay. Well, maybe that'll win over some of the college students for them, perhaps. So how significant then, I mean, you talked a little bit about the history, but in terms of the continued funding and operation of the Regulatory Studies Center, how significant is Koch money there?
Well, so they don't say who their funders are for the most part, but we're able to look at foundations and what they disclose contributing to the Regulatory Studies Center. And we were able to conclude that big contributors include the Koch Foundation run by Charles Koch. Exxon is another big contributor. There's another thing called the Searle Freedom Trust, which is almost a cousin of the Koch Foundation. It's another free market foundation. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is another, and then a whole bunch of industry trade associations and even some individuals who are big figures in the anti-regulatory world in Washington, like, for instance, David Rosen, who helped to write the proposal to freeze fuel economy standards and just recently was bumped up to being the deputy attorney general.
So I've previously read about the Koch brothers setting up like endowed chairs and things like that at universities. I know in Florida they get involved with economics departments, things like that. How broad is this sort of issue? I know that that's not the principal focus of your study, but are we talking about many universities across the United States that they are personally involved in?
And that's an excellent question, and I think it is part and parcel, a big part of our study. So Charles Koch has been talking about using universities to influence policy since at least 1974, and was very explicit about it. He said that this is a way to influence policy that doesn't evoke the same kind of reaction as traditional politics does. And they have built this program up over the years, and according to one conversation that was recorded, unbeknownst to the Kochs, back in 2016. They're funding more than 50 university centers right now.
Wow. So there's a good chance that if someone is listening to this going to a university, they might be at one that has something like this. And yeah. I'm trying to understand, like, what the, from the point of view of a student at one of these universities, or even the faculty at one of these universities, of grad students, what is the benefit to the university? What does this actually have to do with the university? Are professors working at this center? Are students helping to write up reports? Are they being indoctrinated into this sort of work?
I guess it's kind of, I suppose it could probably vary by university. I would say that a lot of the universities that the Kochs have funded have not been huge names on a national scale. College of Charleston, Troy University in Alabama, and a Clemson University. I mean, I don't mean to denigrate those universities, but traditionally they haven't been Ivy League schools and such. So I suppose one of the aspects for the Kochs is they're bringing in, they're pumping in resources and funding. And, you know, what university is going to look away from that, all things being equal? So I think that that's a big one. I think it also probably raises university's profile, although it can come with some baggage. But the base camp for the Kochs has always been George Mason University here in Northern University. And that university's profile has been risen, has been increased significantly because of the Kochs funding. It's also taken a lot of hits to its reputation, but, you know, maybe they could argue nobody even know who we were if it hadn't been for all of this funding from the Kochs.
And so, as you pointed out, this is a way to have an influence on politics without sort of raising people's red flags, like through traditional political means. And so the sort of work that you and the center are doing to shed light on this is incredibly important. And so we appreciate your contribution in that area.
Well, I really thank you for having me.
Thank you. Hopefully we'll talk to you again soon. We're going to take a short break here. We come back, updates on the wall, Donald Trump getting involved in its design and even its color after this. Donald Trump wants a wall. We all sort of get that at this point, but he doesn't just want any wall. He has incredibly specific designs on what this wall should actually look like. And it is causing literal departments of the federal government to go to ridiculous lengths to explain why they are doing what they're doing at great cost to the taxpayers to appease his, I guess it's exterior design wishes. So days after the Department of Homeland Security told Congress it needed US troops to paint the southern border wall with Mexico to improve its aesthetic appearance, the Pentagon claimed Friday the maintenance assignment will also have a deterrent effect since American forces will carry out the job with, quote, anti-climb paint. The cost of the materials involved in the paint job is $150,000. It's expected to take 30 days. And lest you believe, oh, $150,000 to paint the entire wall. No, it's like a couple miles to the wall. Don't get carried away. If they do this to the entire thing, it is going to be very, very costly. And so we know that he's been apparently talking about wanting it to be painted a particular color for literally months now at this point. And it looks like that is so laughable that they're now having to claim, no, it's too make it slippery or something.
I know, wait, did you look up anti-climb paint? Because it's something I had never heard of before, ever in
I
my
get
life.
It, sort of.
I
imagine, have you seen one of those steel bollard fences? It looks tough to climb regardless,
right.
I would imagine. Mm-hmm. And anything you would use to get to the top, I imagine the paint's not gonna do much to it.
Right.
And so, is it really about the anti-climb though? I don't think so, and
really?
Neither does Donald Trump apparently. So I wanna go back to May 16th when the Washington Post had a piece going into how Donald Trump wanted this wall to look and to function. It said then, the bollards or slats, as he prefers to call them, I don't know why you can't just call them bollards since they're bollards, should be painted flat black, a dark hue that would absorb heat in the summer, making the metal too hot for climbers to scale. That's what he told White House aides, Homeland Security officials, and military engineers. And so he wants it to look cool and ominous. He's got, you know, the Darth Vader thing going on, but he also wants it to be so hot that it will sear the flesh of anyone trying to climb it. But if you actually get past the hot surface, he's got a surprise for you at the top. He wants the tips of the bollards to be pointed, not round, the president insisted, describing in graphic terms the potential injuries that border crossers might receive. So he also wanted them, if they got to the top, to be gored on sharp points at the top. And then, and I don't even know what this is about really, he says that the wall's current blueprints include too many gates placed at periodic intervals to allow vehicles and people through, and he wants the openings to be smaller. that isn't even about hurting people or deterring people. That's just a guy who has no qualifications whatsoever in this area, that has no knowledge of what the needs of Border Patrol actually is in terms of what is the point of an opening in there. I assume because you need to get through. And if you need more of them, presumably it's because they think that they need that. But he doesn't think that it looks cool enough, and he thinks that the openings are too large. That's what he's spending his day on.
I mean, just the fact that we started this conversation talking about spending, wasting time and money on what a portion of the wall looks like. That's what it is. And they're admitting that that is what it is, but just saying it there's a benefit also because this paint that comes in this color that he wants is going to be anti-climb paint.
Which I don't, I still don't know exactly what that means. I have to assume that means it's slippery. I don't know. But it's, there's a couple of different possibilities.
It's what?
It's hot.
It's hot.
Well, look, any black paint is gonna be hot. I don't know why that's particularly anti-climb, but that's what they're saying. So one of at least two things is going on, and I don't like either of them. Either Donald Trump is actually getting involved with the micromanagement of the design of individual portions of the wall because he genuinely believes that he's going to injure climbers either through hot paint or by spiking them on the top like some sort of psycho. And he actually thinks that will work and wants that to work, or he just wants a photo op in front of an incredibly scary looking portion of border wall.
Absolutely, this is just an excuse to keep this in the news, to keep this to be something that we're talking about, to the fact that he lost you know, on his evil, racist, massive waste of money wall.
In the mid, oh, you're talking about the actual battle over that.
Right, yeah, this is just an excuse to, you know, we're still doing it. Of course we're doing it, and Mexico's gonna pay for it. Matter of fact, are they paying for this paint?
No, I don't think so.
You know what I mean?
I imagine you and I are paying for
this
paint.
Right, exactly. Like we're paying for the golf trip.
Yeah, now he, look, in the midterms, they tried to make the midterms about the caravan and people getting over the wall and scaring people. They put up the videos and they try to scare you with the videos of gang members and stuff like that. And they of course lost those midterms. I mean, as you point out, he seems to want to keep this in the news. Is that a good plan for him? The fact that we won in the midterms, does that make you feel a little bit more comfortable about us talking about this sort of thing, since it seems to be doing more to cause opposition to Donald Trump than support for him?
How often have we decided that something was not a good plan for him and then it turns out his base just doesn't care about logic?
Yeah, no, so I don't doubt that his base.
Because I think anything and everything he says always turns out to be a good plan for him. He literally put babies in cages, took them away from their breastfeeding mothers, took them away from their parents, traumatized them. And that turned out to be a good plan for him.
But I think you're answering a different question than I'm asking. I'm not questioning whether that helps him with his base. I'm questioning whether that base can win national elections for him.
I hope not.
Because he did lose in the midterms.
Right.
And I agree, they're gonna like literally anything. And if he decided to make this wall look like, you know, Winterfell before the Great War and have just shards of dragon glass sticking out of it, I'm sure 30% of this country would cheer for that. My hope is that we as a country are not in favor of that. And that it's one thing to try to win individual congressional districts, but to win a national election, I'm hoping that that will not actually help him.
For one, I still think that we should have a counter up in the bottom of the screen on how many days, minutes, moments you can go without a Game of Thrones reference. And I thought it would slow down once the show ended.
It's one in the whole show. Is that really so
bad? No, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Okay, well, anyway, so that's what your president is doing. Instead of fixing the actual problems our country has, he's going down to the wall.
Making a wall pretty.
And he's saying the gate's too wide.
Yeah.
By the way, he also he's repeatedly stressed that the wall has to be as tall as possible. You can interpret the psychological reason behind that however you want.
Right.
But he apparently wants it to be tall.
This is such a waste of time and energy and money.
And money. And
$150,000.
As they point out, one administration official pointed out, once you paint it, you always have to paint it. And that's going to be an incredibly high cost going forward. Okay, just really fast, I want to read this before we go because you guys have been leaving some great comments over this last week. One person said, and you'll like this, love starting off my week with Brooke and John. That was Belle of the Brawl said that. So thank you, Belle of the Brawl. Anybody else who hasn't already left a review on iTunes, please do that. We'll read it on tomorrow's show. Thank you as always.
Thanks
we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.